To prove women's inferiority, anti-feminists began to draw not only, as before, on religion, philosophy, and theology, but also on science, biology, experimental psychology, and so forth. At most, they were willing to grant separate but equal status to the other sex. Note, l'égalité dans la différence, in the French text, literal translation, different but equal. Translation. That winning formula is most significant. It is exactly that formula the Jim Crow laws put into practice with regard to Black Americans. This so-called egalitarian segregation served only to introduce the most extreme forms of discrimination. This convergence is in no way pure chance. Whether it is race, caste, class, or sex reduced to an inferior condition, the justification process is the same. The eternal feminine corresponds to the Black soul, or the Jewish character. However, the Jewish problem on the whole is very different from the two others. For the anti-Semite, the Jew is more an enemy than an inferior, and no place on this earth is recognized as his own. It would be preferable to see him annihilated. But there are deep analogies between the situations of women and Blacks. Both are liberated today from the same paternalism, and the former master caste wants to keep them in their place, that is, the place chosen for them. In both cases, they praise, more or less sincerely, the virtues of the good Black, the carefree, childlike merry soul of the resigned Black, and the woman who is a true woman, frivolous, infantile, irresponsible, the woman subjugated to man. In both cases, the ruling caste bases its argument on the state of affairs it created itself. The familiar line from George Bernard Shaw sums it up. The white American relegates the Black to the rank of shoeshine boy, and then concludes that Blacks are only good for shining shoes. The same vicious circle can be found in all analogous circumstances. When an individual or a group of individuals is kept in a situation of inferiority, the fact is that he or they are inferior. But the scope of the verb to be must be understood. Bad faith means giving it a substantive value, when in fact it has the sense of the Hegelian dynamic. To be is to have become, to have been made as one manifests oneself. Yes, women in general are, today, inferior to men. That is, their situation provides them with fewer possibilities. The question is whether this state of affairs must be perpetuated. Many men wish it would be. Not all men have yet laid down their arms. The conservative bourgeoisie continues to view women's liberation as a danger threatening their morality and their interests. Some men feel threatened by women's competition. In Hebdo Latin the other day, a student declared, "Every woman student who takes a position as a doctor or lawyer is stealing a place from us." That student never questioned his rights over this world. Economic interests are not the only ones in play. One of the benefits that oppression secures for the oppressor is that the humblest among them feels superior. In the United States, a poor white from the South can console himself for not being a dirty nigger, and more prosperous whites cleverly exploit this pride. Likewise, the most mediocre of males believes himself a demigod next to women. It was easier for Monsieur de Montelon to think himself a hero in front of women, hand-picked, by the way, than to act the man among men, a role that many women assumed better than he did. Thus, in one of his articles in Le Figaro Littéraire in September 1948, Monsieur Claude Mauriac, whom everyone admires for his powerful originality, could write about women. Note, at least he thought he could. "We listen in a tone of polite indifference to the most brilliant one among them, knowing that her intelligence, in a more or less dazzling way, reflects ideas that come from us." Clearly, his female interlocutor does not reflect Monsieur Mauriac's own ideas, since he is known not to have any. That she reflects ideas originating with men is possible. Among males themselves, more than one of them takes as his own opinions he did not invent. One might wonder if it would not be in Monsieur Claude Mauriac's interest to converse with a good reflection of Descartes, Marx, or Gide, rather than with himself. What is remarkable is that with the ambiguous we, he identifies with St. Paul, Hegel, Lenin, and Nietzsche, and from their heights, he looks down on the herd of women who dare to speak to him on an equal footing. Frankly, I know of more than one woman who would not put up with Monsieur Mauriac's tone of polite indifference. I have stressed this example because of its disarming masculine naivete. Men profit in many other more subtle ways from women's alterity. For all those suffering from an inferiority complex, this is a miraculous liniment. No one is more arrogant toward women, more aggressive, or more disdainful than a man anxious about his own virility. Those who are not threatened by their fellow men are far more likely to recognize woman as a counterpart. But even for them, the myth of the woman, of the other, remains precious for many reasons. They can hardly be blamed for not wanting to lightheartedly sacrifice all the benefits they derive from the myth. They know what they lose by relinquishing the woman of their dreams, but they do not know what the woman of tomorrow will bring them. Note, the article by Michel Carouge on this theme in Cahiers du Sud, number 292, is significant. He writes with indignation, "If only there were no feminine myth, but only bands of cooks, matrons, prostitutes, and blue stockings with functions of pleasure or utility." So, according to him, woman has no existence for herself. He only takes into account her function in the male world. Her finality is in man. In fact, it is possible to prefer her poetic function to all others. The exact question is why she should be defined in relation to the man. It takes great abnegation to refuse to posit oneself as unique and absolute subject. Besides, the vast majority of men do not explicitly make this position their own. They do not posit woman as inferior. They are too imbued today with the democratic ideal not to recognize all human beings as equals. Within the family, the male child and then the young man sees the woman as having the same social dignity as the adult male. Afterward, he experiences in desire and love the resistance and independence of the desired and loved woman. Married, he respects in his wife the spouse and the mother, and in the concrete experience of married life, she affirms herself opposite him as a freedom. He can thus convince himself that there is no longer a social hierarchy between the sexes, and that on the whole, in spite of their differences, woman is an equal. As he nevertheless recognizes some points of inferiority, professional incapacity being the predominant one, he attributes them to nature. When he has an attitude of benevolence and partnership toward a woman, he applies the principle of abstract equality, and he does not posit the concrete inequality he recognizes. But as soon as he clashes with her, the situation is reversed. He will apply the concrete inequality theme and will even allow himself to disavow abstract equality. Note, for example, man declares that he does not find his wife in any way diminished just because she does not have a profession. Work in the home is just as noble, and so on. Yet, at the first argument, he remonstrates, "You wouldn't be able to earn a living without me." This is how many men affirm with quasi-good faith that women are equal to men and have no demands to make, and at the same time, that women will never be equal to men and that their demands are in vain. It is difficult for men to measure the enormous extent of social discrimination that seems insignificant from the outside and whose moral and intellectual repercussions are so deep in woman that they appear to spring from an original nature. Note, describing this very process will be the object of Volume 2 of this study. The man most sympathetic to women never knows her concrete situation fully, so there is no good reason to believe men when they try to defend privileges whose scope they cannot even fathom. We will not let ourselves be intimidated by the number and violence of attacks against women, nor be fooled by the self-serving praise showered on the real woman, nor be won over by men's enthusiasm for her destiny, a destiny they would not for the world want to share. We must not, however, be any less mistrustful of feminists' arguments. Very often, their attempt to polemicize robs them of all value. If the question of women is so trivial, it is because masculine arrogance turned it into a quarrel. When people quarrel, they no longer reason well. What people have endlessly sought to prove is that woman is superior, inferior, or equal to man. Created after Adam, she is obviously a secondary being, some say. On the contrary, say others, Adam was only a rough draft, and God perfected the human being when he created Eve. Her brain is smaller, but relatively bigger. Christ was made man, but perhaps out of humility. Every argument has its opposite, and both are often misleading. To see clearly, one needs to get out of these ruts, these vague notions of superiority, inferiority, and equality that have distorted all discussions must be discarded in order to start anew. But how, then, will we ask the question? And in the first place, who are we to ask it? Men are judge and party. So are women. Can an angel be found? In fact, an angel would be ill-qualified to speak, would not understand all the givens of the problem. As for the hermaphrodite, it is a case of its own. It is not both a man and a woman, but neither man nor woman. I think certain women are still best suited to elucidate the situation of women. It is a sophism to claim that Epimenides should be enclosed within the concept of Cretan and all Cretans, within the concept of a liar. It is not a mysterious essence that dictates good or bad faith to men and women. It is their situation that disposes them to seek the truth to a greater or lesser extent. Many women today, fortunate to have had all the privileges of the human being restored to them, can afford the luxury of impartiality. We even feel the necessity of it. We are no longer like our militant predecessors. We have more or less won the game. In the latest discussions on women's status, the UN has not ceased to imperiously demand equality of the sexes. And indeed, many of us have never felt our femaleness to be a difficulty or an obstacle. Many other problems seem more essential than those that concern us uniquely. This very detachment makes it possible to hope our attitude will be objective. Yet we know the feminine world more intimately than men do because our roots are in it. We grasp more immediately what the fact of being female means for a human being, and we care more about knowing it. I said that there are more essential problems, but this one still has a certain importance from our point of view. How will the fact of being women have affected our lives? What precise opportunities have been given us, and which ones have been denied? What destiny awaits our younger sisters, and in which direction should we point them? It is striking that most feminine literature is driven today by an attempt at lucidity more than by a will to make demands. Coming out of an era of muddled controversy, this book is one attempt, among others, to take stock of the current state. But it is no doubt impossible to approach any human problem without partiality. Even the way of asking the questions, of adopting perspectives, presupposes hierarchies of interests. All characteristics comprise values. Every so-called objective description is set against an ethical background. Instead of trying to conceal those principles that are more or less explicitly implied, we would be better off stating them from the start. Then it would not be necessary to specify on each page the meaning given to the words superior, inferior, better, worse, progress, regression, and so on. If we examine some of the books on women, we see that one of the most frequently held points of view is that of public good or general interest. In reality, This is taken to mean the interest of society as each one wishes to maintain or establish it. In our opinion, there is no public good other than one that assures the citizen's private good. We judge institutions from the point of view of the concrete opportunities they give to individuals. But neither do we confuse the idea of private interest with happiness. That is another frequently encountered point of view. Are women in a harem not happier than a woman voter? Is a housewife not happier than a woman worker? We cannot really know what the word happiness means, and still less what authentic values it covers. There is no way to measure the happiness of others, and it is always easy to call a situation that one would like to impose on others happy. In particular, we declare happy those condemned to stagnation, under the pretext that happiness is immobility. This is a notion, then, we will not refer to. The perspective we have adopted is one of existentialist morality. Every subject posits itself as a transcendence concretely, through projects. It accomplishes its freedom only by perpetual surpassing toward other freedoms. There is no other justification for present existence than its expansion toward an indefinitely open future. Every time transcendence lapses into immanence, there is degradation of existence into in itself, of freedom into facticity. This fall is a moral fault if the subject consents to it. If this fall is inflicted on the subject, it takes the form of frustration and oppression. In both cases, it is an absolute evil. Every individual concerned with justifying his existence experiences his existence as an indefinite need to transcend himself. But what singularly defines the situation of woman is that being, like all humans, an autonomous freedom, she discovers and chooses herself in a world where men force her to assume herself as other. An attempt is made to freeze her as an object and doom her to immanence, since her transcendence will be forever transcended by another essential and sovereign consciousness. Woman's drama lies in this conflict between the fundamental claim of every subject, which always posits itself as essential, and the demands of a situation that constitutes her as inessential. How, in the feminine condition, can a human being accomplish herself? What paths are open to her? Which ones lead to dead ends? How can she find independence within dependence? What circumstances limit women's freedom, and can she overcome them? These are the fundamental questions we would like to elucidate. This means that in focusing on the individual's possibilities, we will define these possibilities not in terms of happiness, but in terms of freedom. Clearly, this problem would have no meaning if we thought that a physiological, psychological, or economic destiny weighed on woman. So, we will begin by discussing woman from a biological, psychoanalytical, and historical materialist point of view. We will then attempt to positively demonstrate how feminine reality has been constituted, why woman has been defined as other, and what the consequences have been from men's point of view. Then we will describe the world from the woman's point of view, such as it is offered to her. Note, this will be the subject of a second volume. And we will see the difficulties women are up against just when, trying to escape the sphere they have been assigned until now, they seek to be part of the human Mitzvah. Part 1. Destiny. Chapter 1. Biological Data. Woman? Very simple, say those who like simple answers. She is a womb, an ovary. She is a female. This word is enough to define her. From a man's mouth, the epithet female sounds like an insult. But he, not ashamed of his animality, is proud to hear, he's a male. The term female is pejorative, not because it roots woman in nature, but because it confines her in her sex. And if the sex, even in an innocent animal, seems despicable and an enemy to man, it is obviously because of the disquieting hostility woman triggers in him. Nevertheless, he wants to find a justification in biology for this feeling. The word female evokes a saraband of images, an enormous round egg snatching and castrating the agile sperm, monstrous and stuffed, the queen termite reigning over the servile males, the praying mantis and the spider gorged on love, crushing their partners and gobbling them up. The dog in heat running through back alleys, leaving perverse smells in her wake. The monkey showing herself off brazenly, sneaking away with flirtatious hypocrisy. And the most splendid wildcats, the tigress, lioness, and panther, lie down slavishly under the male's imperial embrace, inert, impatient, shrewd, stupid, insensitive, lewd, fierce, and humiliated. Man projects all females at once onto woman, and the fact is that she is a female. But if one wants to stop thinking in commonplaces, two questions arise. What does the female represent in the animal kingdom? And what unique kind of female is realized in woman? Males and females are two types of individuals who are differentiated within one species for the purposes of reproduction. They can be defined only correlatively. But it has to be pointed out first that the very meaning of division of the species into two sexes is not clear. It does not occur universally in nature. In one-celled animals, infusorians, amoebas, bacilli, and so on, multiplication is fundamentally distinct from sexuality, with cells dividing and subdividing individually. For some metazoans, reproduction occurs by schizogenesis, that is, dividing the individual whose origin is also asexual, or by blastogenesis, that is, dividing the individual itself produced by a sexual phenomenon. The phenomena of budding or segmentation observed in freshwater hydras, coelenterates, sponges, worms, and tunicates are well-known examples. In parthenogenesis, the virgin egg develops an embryonic form without male intervention. The male plays no role or only a secondary one. Unfertilized honeybee eggs subdivide and produce drones. In the case of aphids, males are absent for a number of generations, and the unfertilized eggs produce females. Parthenogenesis in the sea urchin, the starfish, and the toad has been artificially reproduced. However, sometimes in the protozoa, two cells can merge, forming what is called a zygote. Fertilization is necessary for honeybee eggs to engender females and aphid eggs, males. Some biologists have thus concluded that even in species capable of perpetuating themselves unilaterally, the renewal of genetic diversity through mixing of parental chromosomes would benefit the line's rejuvenation and vigor. In this view, then, in the more complex forms of life, sexuality is an indispensable function. Only elementary organisms could multiply without sexes, and even so, they would exhaust their vitality. But today, this hypothesis is most inexact. Observations have proved that asexual multiplication can occur indefinitely without any noticeable degeneration. This is particularly striking in bacilli, more and more, and bolder and even bolder parthenogenic experiments have been carried out, and in many species, the male seems radically useless. Moreover, even if the value of intercellular exchange could be demonstrated, it would be a purely ungrounded fact. Biology attests to sexual differentiation, but even if biology were imbued with finalism, the differentiation of sexes could not be deduced from cellular structure, laws of cellular multiplication, or any elementary phenomenon. The existence of heterogenetic gametes alone does not necessarily mean there are two distinct sexes. Note, gametes are reproductive cells whose fusion produces an egg. The differentiation of reproductive cells often does not bring about a division of the species into two types. Both can belong to the same individual. This is true of hermaphroditic species, so common in plants and also in many invertebrates, among which are the annulets and mollusks. Reproduction takes place either by self-fertilization or by cross-fertilization. Some biologists use this fact to claim the justification of the established order. They consider gonochorism, that is, the system in which the different gonads belong to distinct individuals, as an improvement on hermaphroditism, realized by evolution. Others, by contrast, consider gonochorism primitive. For those biologists, hermaphroditism would thus be its degeneration. Note, gonads are glands that produce gametes. In any case, these notions of superiority of one system over another involve highly contestable theories concerning evolution. All that can be affirmed with certainty is that these two means of reproduction coexist in nature, that they both perpetuate species, and that the heterogeneity of both gametes and gonad-producing organisms seems to be accidental. The differentiation of individuals into males and females thus occurs as an irreducible and contingent fact. Most philosophies have taken sexual differentiation for granted without attempting to explain it. The Platonic myth has it that in the beginning there were men, women, and androgynes. Each individual had a double face, four arms, four legs, and two bodies joined together. One day they were split into two, as one would split eggs into. And ever since then, each half seeks to recover its other half. The gods decided later that new human beings would be created by the coupling of two unlike halves. This story only tries to explain love. The differentiation of sexes is taken as a given from the start. Aristotle offers no better account. For if cooperation of matter and form is necessary for any action, it is not necessary that active and passive principles be distributed into two categories of heterogenic individuals. St. Thomas declared that woman was an inessential being, which, from a masculine point of view, is a way of positing the accidental character of sexuality. Hegel, however, would have been untrue to his rationalist passion had he not attempted to justify it logically. According to him, sexuality is the mediation by which the subject concretely achieves itself as a genus. The genus is therefore present in the individual as a straining against the inadequacy of its single actuality, as the urge to obtain its self-feeling in the other of its genus, to integrate itself through union with it, and through this mediation to close the genus with itself and bring it into existence. Copulation. Note, Hegel, The Philosophy of Nature, Part 3, Section 369. And a little further along, the process consists in this, that they become in reality what they are in themselves, namely one genus, the same subjective vitality. And Hegel then declares that in order for the process of union to occur, there has to be differentiation of the two sexes. But his demonstration is not convincing. The preconceived idea of locating the three moments of the syllogism in any operation is too obvious here. The surpassing of the individual toward the species, by which individual and species accomplish themselves in their own truth, could occur without the third element, by the simple relation of genitor to child. Reproduction could be asexual. Or the relation to each other could be that of two of the same kind, with differentiation occurring in the singularity of individuals of the same type, as in hermaphroditic species. Hegel's description brings out a very important significance of sexuality. But he always makes the same error of equating significance with reason. It is through sexual activity that men define the sexes and their relations, just as they create the meaning and value of all the functions they accomplish. But sexual activity is not necessarily implied in the human being's nature. In Phénoménologie de la perception, Phenomenology of Perception, Merleau-Ponty points out that human existence calls for revision of the notions of necessity and contingency. Existence has no fortuitous attributes, no content which does not contribute towards giving it its form. It does not give admittance to any pure fact because it is the process by which facts are drawn up. This is true, but it is also true that there are conditions without which the very fact of existence would seem to be impossible. Presence in the world vigorously implies the positing of a body that is both a thing of the world and a point of view on this world. But this body need not possess this or that particular structure. In L'être et le néant, Being and Nothingness, Sartre disputes Heidegger's affirmation that human reality is doomed to death because of its finitude. He establishes that a finite and temporally limitless existence could be conceivable. Nevertheless, if human life were not inhabited by death, the relationship of human beings to the world and to themselves would be so deeply upset that the statement, "Man is mortal," would be anything but an empirical truth. Immortal, inexistent, would no longer be what we call a man. One of the essential features of man's destiny is that the movement of his temporal life creates behind and ahead of him the infinity of the past and the future. The perpetuation of the species appears thus as the correlative of individual limitation. So the phenomenon of reproduction can be considered as ontologically grounded. But this is where one must stop. The perpetuation of the species does not entail sexual differentiation. That it is taken on by existence in such a way that it thereby enters into the concrete definition of existence, so be it. Nevertheless, a consciousness without a body or an immortal human being is rigorously inconceivable, whereas a society can be imagined that reproduces itself by parthenogenesis or is composed of hermaphrodites. Opinions about the respective roles of the two sexes have varied greatly. They were initially devoid of any scientific basis and only reflected social myths. It was thought for a long time and is still thought in some primitive societies based on matrilineal filiation that the father has no part in the child's conception. Ancestral larvae were supposed to infiltrate the womb in the form of living germs. With the advent of patriarchy, the male resolutely claimed his posterity. The mother had to be granted a role in procreation, even though she merely carried and fattened the living seed. The father alone was the creator. Aristotle imagined that the fetus was produced by the meeting of the sperm and the menses. In this symbiosis, woman just provided passive material, while the male principle is strength, activity, movement, and life. Hippocrates' doctrine also recognized two types of seeds, a weak or female one, and a strong one, which was male. Aristotelian theory was perpetuated throughout the Middle Ages and down to the modern period. In the middle of the 17th century, Harvey, slaughtering female deer shortly after they had mated, found vesicles in the uterine horns that he thought were eggs, but that were really embryos. The Danish scientist Steno coined the term ovaries for the female genital glands that had until then been called feminine testicles, and he noted the existence of vesicles on their surface that Graf, in 1672, had erroneously identified as eggs and to which he gave his name. The ovary was still regarded as a homologue of the male gland. That same year, though, spermatic animalcules were discovered penetrating the feminine womb, but it was thought that they went there for nourishment only, and that the individual was already prefigured in them. In 1694, the Dutchman Hartsucker drew an image of the homunculus hidden in the sperm, and in 1699, another scientist declared he had seen the sperm cast off a kind of slough, under which there was a little man, which he also drew. In these hypotheses, woman merely fattened a living and active and perfectly constituted principle. These theories were not universally accepted, and discussion continued until the 19th century. The invention of the microscope led to the study of the animal egg. In 1827, Bayer identified the mammal's egg, an element contained inside Graaf's follicle. Soon, its structure could be studied. In 1835, the sarcode, that is, the protoplasm, and then the cell were discovered. In 1877, the sperm was observed penetrating the starfish egg. From that, the symmetry of the two gametes' nuclei was established. Their fusion was analyzed in detail for the first time in 1883 by a Belgian zoologist. But Aristotle's ideas have not lost all validity. Hegel thought the two sexes must be different. One is active and the other passive. And it goes without saying that passivity will be the female's lot. Because of this differentiation, man is thus the active principle, while woman is the passive principle, because she resides in her non-developed unity. And even when the ovum was recognized as an active principle, men continued to pit its inertia against the agility of the sperm. Today, there is a tendency to see the contrary. The discoveries of parthenogenesis have led some scientists to reduce the role of the male to that of a simple physicochemical agent. In some species, the action of an acid or a mechanical stimulation has been shown to trigger the division of the egg and the development of the embryo. And from that, it was boldly assumed that the male gamete was not necessary for generation. It would be, at most, a ferment. Perhaps man's cooperation in procreation would one day become useless. That seems to be many women's desire. But nothing warrants such a bold expectation because nothing warrants universalizing life's specific processes. The phenomena of asexual multiplication and parthenogenesis are neither more nor less fundamental than those of sexual reproduction. And it has already been noted that this form is not a priori favored, but no fact proves it is reducible to a more elementary mechanism. Rejecting any a priori doctrine, any implausible theory, we find ourselves before a fact that has neither ontological nor empirical basis, and whose impact cannot a priori be understood. By examining it in its concrete reality, we can hope to extract its significance, thus perhaps the content of the word female will come to light. The idea here is not to propose a philosophy of life or to take sides too hastily in the quarrel between finalism and mechanism. Yet it is noteworthy that physiologists and biologists all use a more or less finalistic language merely because they ascribe meaning to vital phenomena. We will use their vocabulary. Without coming to any conclusion about life and consciousness, we can affirm that any living fact indicates transcendence, and that a project is in the making in every function. These descriptions do not suggest more than this. In most species, male and female organisms cooperate for reproduction. They are basically defined by the gametes they produce. In some algae and fungi, the cells that fuse to produce the egg are identical. These cases of isogamy are significant in that they manifest the basal equivalence of the usually differentiated gametes, but their analogy remains striking. Sperm and ova result from a basically identical cellular evolution. The development of primitive female cells into oocytes differs from that of spermatocytes by protoplasmic phenomena, but the nuclear phenomena are approximately the same. The idea the biologist Ansel expressed in 1903 is still considered valid today. An undifferentiated progerminating cell becomes male or female depending on the conditions in the genital gland at the moment of its appearance, conditions determined by the transformation of some epithelial cells into nourishing elements, developers of a special material. This primary kinship is expressed in the structure of the two gametes that carry the same number of chromosomes inside each species. During fertilization, the two nuclei merge their substance, and the chromosomes in each are reduced to half their original number. This reduction takes place in both of them in a similar way. The last two divisions of the ovum result in the formation of polar globules, equivalent to the last divisions of the sperm. It is thought today that depending on the species, the male or female gamete determines the sex. For mammals, the sperm possesses a chromosome that is heterogenic to the others and potentially either male or female. According to Mendel's statistical laws, transmission of hereditary characteristics takes place equally from the father and the mother. What is important to see is that in this meeting, neither gamete takes precedence over the other. They both sacrifice their individuality. The egg absorbs the totality of their substance. There are thus two strong current biases that, at least at this basic biological level, prove false. The first one is the female's passivity. The living spark is not enclosed within either of the two gametes. It springs forth from their meeting. The nucleus of the ovum is a vital principle perfectly symmetrical to the sperm's. The second bias contradicts the first, which does not exclude the fact that they often coexist. The permanence of the species is guaranteed by the female since the male principle has an explosive and fleeting existence. In reality, the embryo equally perpetuates the germ cells of the father and the mother and retransmits them together to its descendants, sometimes in a male and sometimes in a female form. One might say that an androgynous germ cell survives the individual metamorphoses of the soma from generation to generation. That being said, there are highly interesting secondary differences to be observed between the ovum and the sperm. The essential singularity of the ovum is that it is supplied with material destined to nourish and protect the embryo. It stocks up on reserves from which the fetus will build its tissues, reserves that are not a living substance but an inert material. The result is a massive, relatively voluminous, spherical or ellipsoidal form. The bird's egg's dimensions are well known. The woman's egg measures 0.13 millimeters, while the human sperm contains 60,000 sperm per cubic millimeter. Their mass is extremely small. The sperm has a thread-like tail, a little elongated head. No foreign substance weighs it down. It is entirely life. This structure destines it for mobility. The ovum, on the contrary, where the future of the fetus is stored, is a fixed element, enclosed in the female organism or suspended in an exterior environment. It waits passively for fertilization. The male gamete seeks it out. The sperm is always a naked cell, while the ovum is, according to the species, protected or not by a membrane. But in any case, the sperm bumps into the ovum when it comes into contact with it, makes it waver, and infiltrates it. The male gamete loses its tail, its head swells, and twisting, it reaches the nucleus. Meanwhile, the egg immediately forms a membrane that keeps other sperm from entering. For echinoderms, where fertilization is external, it is easy to observe the rush of the sperm that surround the floating and inert egg like a halo. This competition is also another important phenomenon found in most species, much smaller than the ovum. The sperm are generally produced in considerable quantities, and each ovum has many suitors. Thus, the ovum, active in the nucleus, its essential principle, is superficially passive. Its mass, closed upon itself, compact in itself, evokes the nocturnal heaviness and repose of the in itself. The ancients visualized the closed world in the form of a sphere or opaque atom. Immobile, the ovum waits. By contrast, the open sperm, tiny and agile, embodies the impatience and worry of existence. One should not get carried away with the pleasure of allegories. The ovum has sometimes been likened to eminence and the sperm to transcendence. By giving up its transcendence and mobility, the sperm penetrates the female element. It is grabbed and castrated by the inert mass that absorbs it after cutting off its tail. Like all passive actions, this one is magical and disturbing. The male gamete activity is rational, a measurable movement in terms of time and space. In truth, these are merely ramblings. Male and female gametes merge together in the egg. Together, they cancel each other out in their totality. It is false to claim that the egg voraciously absorbs the male gamete, and just as false to say that the latter victoriously appropriates the female cell's reserves, because in the act that merges them, their individuality disappears. And to a mechanistic philosophy, the movement undoubtedly looks like a rational phenomenon par excellence. But for modern physics, the idea is no clearer than that of action at a distance. Besides, the details of the physico-chemical interactions leading to fertilization are not known. It is possible, however, to come away with a valuable indication from this meeting. There are two movements that come together in life, and life maintains itself only by surpassing itself. It does not surpass itself without maintaining itself. These two moments are always accomplished together. It is academic to claim to separate them. Nevertheless, it is either one or the other that dominates. The two unified gametes go beyond and are perpetuated, but the ovum structure anticipates future needs. It is constituted to nourish the life that will awaken in it, while the sperm is in no way equipped to ensure the development of the germ it gives rise to. In contrast, whereas the sperm moves around, the ovum is incapable of triggering the change that will bring about a new explosion of life. Without the egg's prescience, the sperm's action would be useless. But without the latter's initiative, the egg would not accomplish its vital potential. The conclusion is thus, that fundamentally, the role of the two gametes is identical. Together, they create a living being in which both of them lose and surpass themselves. But in the secondary and superficial phenomena that condition fertilization, it is through the male element that the change in situation occurs for the new eclosion of life. It is through the female element that this eclosion is established in a stable element. It would be rash to deduce from such an observation that woman's place is in the home, but there are rash people. In his book, Tempérament et caractère selon les individus, les sexes et les races, Nature and Character According to Individuals, Sex and Race, Alfred Fourier claimed he could define woman entirely from the ovum and man from the sperm. Many so-called deep theories are based on this game of dubious analogies. It is never clear what philosophy of nature this pseudo-thinking refers to. If one considers laws of heredity, men and women come equally from a sperm and an ovum. I suppose that vestiges of the old medieval philosophy, that the cosmos was the exact reflection of a microcosm, are floating around in these foggy minds. It was imagined that the ovum is a female homunculus, and woman a giant ovum. These reveries dismissed since the days of alchemy make a weird contrast with the scientific precision of descriptions being used at this very moment. Modern biology does not mesh with medieval symbolism, but our people do not look all that closely. If one is a bit scrupulous, one has to agree that it is a long way from ovum to woman. The ovum does not yet even contain the very notion of female. Hegel rightly notes that the sexual relationship cannot be reduced to that of two gametes. Thus, the female organism has to be studied in its totality. It has already been pointed out that for many vegetables and some primitive animals, among them mollusks, gamete specification does not lead to individual specification, as they produce both ova and sperm. Even when the sexes separate, the barriers between them are not tight like those that separate species. Just as gametes are defined from an originally undifferentiated tissue, males and females develop more as variations on a common base. For certain animals, the Bonellia viridis is the most typical case. The embryo is first asexual, and its eventual sexuality is determined by the incertitudes of its development. Note, Bonelia viridis is a sandworm that has no sex chromosomes. Translation. It is accepted today that in most species, sex determination depends on the genotypical constitution of the egg. The virgin egg of the honeybee, reproducing itself by parthenogenesis, yields males exclusively. That of fruit flies, in the exact same conditions, yields females exclusively. When eggs are fertilized, it is to be noted that, except for some spiders, an approximately equal number of male and female individuals is procreated. Differentiation comes from the heterogeneity of one of the two types of gametes. For mammals, sperm possess either a male or a female potentiality. It is not really known what determines the singular character of heterogenic gametes during spermatogenesis or oogenesis. In any case, Mendel's statistical laws are sufficient to explain their regular distribution. For both sexes, fertilization and the beginning of embryonic development occur in an identical way. The epithelial tissue destined to evolve into a gonad is undifferentiated at the outset. At a certain stage of maturation, testicles take shape, or later the ovary takes form. This explains why there are many intermediaries between hermaphroditism and gonochorism. Very often, one of the sexes possesses certain organs characteristic of the complementary sex. The toad is the most striking case of that. The male has an atrophied ovary, called Bitter's organ, that can be made to produce eggs artificially. Mammals also have vestiges of this sexual bipotentiality. For example, the pedicled and sessile hydra, the uterus masculinus, mammary glands in the male, Gartner's duct in the female, and the clitoris. Even in species where sexual division is the most clear-cut, there are individuals that are both male and female simultaneously. Cases of intersexuality are numerous in animals and human beings, and in butterflies and crustaceans, there are examples of gynandromorphism, in which male and female characteristics are juxtaposed in a kind of mosaic. Genotypically defined, the fetus is nevertheless deeply influenced by the milieu from which it draws its nourishment. For ants, honeybees, and termites, how nutrition occurs makes the larva a realized female or thwarts its sexual maturation, reducing it to the rank of worker. The influence in this case pervades the whole organism. For insects, the soma is sexually defined very early and does not depend on gonads. For vertebrates, it is essentially the gonadic hormones that play a regulatory role. Many experiments have demonstrated that varying the endocrine milieu makes it possible to act on sex determination. Other grafting and castration experiments carried out on adult animals have led to the modern theory of sexuality. In male and female vertebrates, the soma is identical and can be considered a neutral element. The action of the gonad gives it its sexual characteristics. Some of the secreted hormones act as stimulants and others as inhibitors. The genital tract itself is somatic, and embryology shows that it takes shape under the influence of hormones from bisexual precursors. Intersexuality exists when hormonal balance has not been realized and when neither of the two sexual potentialities has been clearly accomplished. Equally distributed in the species and evolved analogously from identical roots, male and female organisms seem profoundly symmetrical once they are formed. Both are characterized by the presence of gamete-producing glands, ovaries, or testicles, with the analogous processes of spermatogenesis and oogenesis. As was heard earlier, these glands deliver their secretion in a more or less complex canal according to the hierarchy of the species. The female drops the egg directly by the oviduct and holds it in the cloaca, or in a differentiated uterus, before expelling it. The male either lets go of the semen outside or is equipped with a copulating organ that allows it to penetrate the female. Statistically, the male and the female thus look like two complementary types. They have to be envisaged from a functional point of view to grasp their singularity. It is very difficult to give a generally valid description of the notion of female. defining her as a carrier of ova and the male as a carrier of sperm is insufficient because the relation of organism to gonads is extremely variable. Inversely, the differentiation of the gametes does not directly affect the organism as a whole. It was sometimes claimed that as the ovum was bigger, it consumed more living force than the sperm. But the latter is secreted in infinitely greater quantity so that in the two sexes, the expenditure balances out. Spermatogenesis was taken as an example of prodigality and ovulation a model of economy. But in this phenomenon, there is also an absurd profusion. The immense majority of eggs are never fertilized. In any case, gametes and gonads are not microcosms of the whole organism. This is what has to be studied directly. One of the most noteworthy features when surveying the steps of the animal ladder is that, from bottom to top, life becomes more individual. At the bottom, it concentrates on the maintenance of the species, and at the top, it puts its energies into single individuals. In lower species, the organism is reduced to barely more than the reproductive apparatus. In this case, the ovum, and therefore the female, takes precedence over everything else, since it is above all the ovum that is dedicated to the sheer repetition of life. But it is barely more than an abdomen, and its existence is entirely devoured by the work of a monstrous ovulation. It reaches gigantic dimensions compared with the male, but its members are often just stumps, its body a formless bag. All the organs have degenerated to nourish the eggs. In truth, although they constitute two distinct organisms, males and females can hardly be thought of as individuals. They form one whole with elements that are inextricably linked. These are intermediary cases between hermaphroditism and gonochorism. For the entonacid, parasites that live off the crab, the female is a kind of whitish sausage surrounded by incubating slivers harboring thousands of eggs. In their midst are minuscule males as well as larvae, destined to provide replacement males. The enslavement of the dwarf male is even more total in the Edriolydnus. It is attached beneath the female's operculum and is without a digestive tube of its own. It is solely devoted to reproduction. In all these cases, the female is just as enslaved as the male. She is a slave to the species. While the male is fastened to his spouse is also fastened either to a living organism on which she feeds as a parasite or to a mineral substratum. She is consumed by producing eggs the minuscule male fertilizes. As life takes on more complex forms, individual autonomy develops with the loosening of the link uniting the sexes, but insects of both sexes remain tightly subordinate to the eggs. In the case of ephemerals, both spouses often die after coitus and laying, and in the case of rotifers and mosquitoes, the male, lacking a digestive apparatus, sometimes perishes after fertilization, while the female can feed herself and survive. Egg formation and laying take time. The mother dies as soon as the next generation's future has been assured. The privilege of many female insects comes from the fact that fertilization is generally a rapid process, while ovulation and incubation of the eggs demand a long period of time. For termites, the enormous mush-stuffed queen that lays an egg a second until she is sterile and then is pitilessly massacred is no less a slave than the dwarf male attached to her abdomen that fertilizes the eggs as they are expelled. In bee and ant matriarchies, males are intruders that are massacred each season. At the time of the wedding flight, all the male ants escape from the anthill and fly toward the females. If they reach and fertilize them, they die immediately, exhausted. If not, the female workers refuse them entry. They kill them in front of the entrances or let them starve to death. But the fertilized female has a sad fate. She digs herself into the earth alone and often dies from exhaustion while laying the first eggs. If she manages to reconstitute a colony, she is imprisoned for 12 years laying eggs ceaselessly. The female workers, whose sexuality has been atrophied, live for 4 years, but their whole life is devoted to raising the larvae. Likewise for the bees. the drone that catches the queen in her wedding flight crashes to the ground eviscerated. The other drones return to their colony, where they are unproductive and in the way. At the beginning of the winter, they are killed. But the sterile worker bees trade their right to life for incessant work. The queen is really the hive slave. She lays eggs ceaselessly, and the old queen dies. Some larvae are nourished so they can try to succeed her. The first one hatched kills the others in the cradle. The female giant spider carries her eggs in a bag until they reach maturity. She is bigger and stronger than the male, and she sometimes devours him after coupling. The same practices can be seen in the praying mantis, which has taken shape as the myth of devouring femininity. The egg castrates the sperm, and the praying mantis assassinates her spouse. These facts prefigure a woman's dream of castration. But in truth, the praying mantis only manifests such cruelty in captivity. Free, and with rich enough food around, she rarely makes a meal out of the male. If she does, it is like the solitary ant that often eats some of her own eggs in order to have the strength to lay eggs and perpetuate the species. Seeing in these facts the harbinger of the battle of the sexes that sets individuals as such against each other is just rambling. Neither for the ants, nor the honeybees, nor the termites, nor the spider, nor the praying mantis, can one say that the female enslaves and devours the male. It is the species that devours both of them in different ways. The female lives longer and seems to have more importance, but she has no autonomy. Laying, incubation, and care of the larvae make up her whole destiny. Her other functions are totally or partially atrophied. By contrast, an individual existence takes shape in the male. He very often takes more initiative than the female in fertilization. It is he who seeks her out, who attacks, palpates, seizes her, and imposes coitus on her. Sometimes he has to fight off other males. Accordingly, the organs of locomotion, touch, and prehension are also often more developed. Many female butterflies are apterous, whereas their males have wings. Males have more developed colors, elytrons, feet, and claws, and sometimes this profusion can also be seen in a luxurious vanity of gorgeous colors. Aside from the fleeting coitus, the male's life is useless, gratuitous. Next to the diligence of worker females, the laziness of drones is a privilege worth noting. But this privilege is outrageous. The male often pays with his life for this uselessness that contains the germ of independence. A species that enslaves the female punishes the male attempting to escape. It eliminates him brutally. In the higher forms of life, reproduction becomes the production of differentiated organisms. It has a twofold face: maintenance of the species and creation of new individuals. This innovative aspect asserts itself as the singularity of the individual is confirmed. It is thus striking that these two moments of perpetuation and creation divide. This break, already marked at the time of the egg's fertilization, is present in the generating phenomenon as a whole. The structure of the egg itself does not order this division. The female, like the male, possesses a certain autonomy, and her link with the egg loosens. The female fish, amphibian, and bird are much more than an abdomen. The weaker the mother-to-egg link, the less labor parturition involves, and the more undifferentiated is the relation between parents and their offspring. Sometimes the newly hatched lives are the father's responsibility. This is often the case with fish. Water is an element that can carry eggs and sperm and enables their meeting. Fertilization in the aquatic milieu is almost always external. Fish do not mate. At best, some rub against each other for stimulation. The mother expels the ova and the father the sperm. They have identical roles. There is no more reason for the mother to recognize the eggs as her own than the father. In some species, parents abandon the eggs, which develop without help. Sometimes the mother has prepared a nest for them. Sometimes she watches over them after fertilization, but very often the father takes charge of them. As soon as he has fertilized them, he chases away the female, who tries to devour them. He fiercely defends them from anything that approaches. There are those that put up a kind of protective nest by emitting air bubbles covered with an isolating substance. They also often incubate the eggs in their mouths or, like the seahorse, in the folds of the stomach. Analogous phenomena can be seen in toads. They do not have real coitus. The male embraces the female, and this embrace stimulates the laying. While the eggs are coming out of the cloaca, the male lets out his sperm. Very often, and in particular in the toad known as the midwife toad, the father winds the strings of eggs around his feet and carries them around to guarantee their hatching. As for birds, the egg forms rather slowly within the female. The egg is both relatively big and hard to expel. It has much closer relations with the mother than with the father that fertilized it during a quick coitus. The female is the one who usually sits on it and then looks after the young. But very frequently, the father participates in the nest's construction and the protection and nutrition of the young. There are rare cases, for example, the passerine, where the male sits on the eggs and then raises the young. Male and female pigeons secrete a kind of milk in their crop that they feed to the fledglings. What is noteworthy in all these cases in which fathers play a nurturing role is that spermatogenesis stops during the period they devote to their offspring. Busy with maintaining life, the father has no impetus to bring forth new life forms. The most complex and concretely individualized life is found in mammals. The split of the two vital moments, maintaining and creating, takes place definitively in the separation of the sexes. In this branching out and considering vertebrates only, the mother has the closest connection to her offspring, whereas the father is more uninterested. The whole organism of the female is adapted to and determined by the servitude of maternity, while the sexual initiative is the prerogative of the male. The female is the prey of the species. For one or two seasons, depending on the case, her whole life is regulated by a sexual cycle, the estrous cycle, whose length and periodicity vary from one species to another. This cycle has two phases. During the first one, the ova mature. The number varies according to the species, and a nidification process occurs in the womb. In the second phase, a fat necrosis is produced, ending in the elimination of the